Donald Trump created a political earthquake on November 8th when he captured the presidency. And one of the people in Washington who hopes to be a check on Trump's newfound power is U.S. Senator Dick Durbin. The Democrat from Illinois joins us next on another edition of Politically Speaking.
9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I think that is fair
As
to
I say.
Say,
hands to kiss and babies to shake. But
you know, I think my record speaks for itself.
That's a really good question.
Welcome to the Politically Speaking podcast. I'm your host, Jason Rosenbaum, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Joining me in studio today is
colleague Joe Manis.
And joining us from Washington, D.C., we have as our special guest
Dick Durbin,
the U.S. Senator from Illinois. This is a complete honor for you to be on this show as an Illinois native. I know it's also a big honor for Joe, who used to cover you when you were in Congress, when she was working for the Post-Dispatch.
Yes, and the senator is a senior senator from Illinois, one of the top leaders in the U.S. Senate on the Democratic side. So real thanks so much for being on here. We're interested, obviously, in your just general thoughts about, you know, things got a little crazy after November 8th, and now we're looking at a Trump presidency. And I'm just, what's your thoughts about how things are going to proceed, especially among Democrats? Because it looks like the Senate Democrats may be the only roadblock to most of what Trump wants to do.
There will be 48 Senate Democrats, 52 Republicans. Some of the more controversial measures in the Senate require 60 votes to break what we call the filibuster. And so it means that at least in the Senate, the Democratic minority will have a voice when it comes to major issues. And that, of course, is a little different than the House, where the Republicans outnumber the Democratic members, and that is not likely to occur very often. So we'll probably have more confrontation here or opportunity for compromise, whichever way you want to look at it.
Well, before we go further, do you want to give our listeners just a little bit about your background? Because since you are a major player and you're from across the river in Illinois.
Born and raised East St. Louis, Illinois, and lived there in Fairview Heights when I was in the region. Went to a local high school, Assumption High School for Catholic Boys, which has now been closed and sold to the state and turned into a prison. So I drive past the old alma mater and see they're keeping the kids after school. Went on to Georgetown University, came out of law school there, and went to work in Springfield for the lieutenant governor back in those days, Paul Simon, who was from Troy, Illinois,
yes,
down in the same region. He got me started running for office and stuck with me through a couple ill-fated campaigns. And eventually I joined him as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives representing Central Illinois. Did that for 14 years. Paul retired from the Senate, and I succeeded him 20 years ago.
And I've known from covering you whenever you're in the region, you still pay pretty close attention to how East St. Louis and the Metro East are doing from a local standpoint. Obviously, it's a part of Illinois that has a lot of economic and governmental troubles. There was recently news about public corruption in East St. Louis and the surrounding cities. I just wanted to get a sense of like why you continue to pay close attention to that part of the state and to its local affairs, and what you can do as a U.S. senator to help or assist with, you know, that part of the region moving forward.
Whenever I run into somebody and they say they're from St. Louis, I tell them, well, I'm from a suburb of St. Louis. And they say, well, which one? And I said, East St. Louis. They said, that's not a suburb of St. Louis. For a long time, it's kind of been, you know, across the river, a new set of problems, a new set of challenges. For the record, I had a great childhood, grew up in that town, and had great experiences and great memories. The town has had nothing but hard times for 50 years plus. The combination of poverty and corruption has really taken its toll on some families that are victimized by it almost every day. So I've tried to push for those that I think are honest and really care about the future of the city. I've worked for the election of the current mayor. I think she has some promise herself, but she has her hands full. My feeling is this. I owe something back to the area where I grew up, my hometown, and I want to help them where I can. One point, I mean, just a small point, I decided it turns out the federal government's the biggest landlord in East St. Louis. People live in public housing there. And it turns out that public housing was notoriously dangerous. Years ago, we put in money for more security, for fences, for cameras, and things changed for the better in a hurry. It's a small thing, but for the families that live there, it means it makes a big difference.
So transitioning into the future under President Trump, I would say it's an understatement to say that there's going to be a major philosophical and style shift from your former Senate colleague and friend, President Barack Obama, to President Donald Trump. Even the transition so far has been riddled with controversy and intrigue. What's been kind of your perception as one of the more powerful Democrats in the Senate about how President-elect Trump is putting together his administration? And what role do you think the Senate is going to take when some of these nominees come before them to be voted up or down?
I've been through three transitions from Democrat to Republican, and I've seen new presidents take control, bring in a new cabinet, new team, new approach. And, you know, it's just part of living in Washington. It's part of what you expect. This is much different. What happened November 8th was really unprecedented in American history, and I like to study that history. We've never had such a dramatic campaign, dramatic in many positive but also many negative ways. And now a new president with literally no government experience, which many people felt was a plus, and they wanted to bring in a new face with new ideas. And now he's assembling his team. And it's interesting to watch the people who are brought into Trump Tower on a daily basis and paraded in through the lobby by the cameras and go up for interviews. You can't quite tell who's making the final decisions here. I think the vice president-elect, Mike Pence, governor of Indiana, is playing a larger role because of his government experience, his experience in the House of Representatives. But as this team's assembled, it's pretty clear there's going to be a departure from past policy. Some of it you can expect as a Republican takes over from a Democrat, and some of it is a little more on the edge, a little more extreme. You know, there's controversy surrounding some of the staffers that President-elect Trump has around him. Steve Bannon is one of them. We look at some of the things he said and done and worry about what that means to the new administration. So it's kind of a wait-and-see attitude here. We get good reports some days from the Trump administration in formation, and some days not so good from a Democratic point of view.
Now, are you concerned at all? I mean, Trump has been spending a lot of time in Trump Tower. Of course, right now he's not the president yet. But there's a perception or predictions that he may actually be spending a lot of time in New York, even as president, and that he's only going to be in Washington when he has to be. Do you have any, I mean, that would be unprecedented. I'm just interested in your observations based on a Washington veteran, and as you're watching some of this.
I've talked to some people in the White House, and they believe the clues are out there that he wants to be a commuting president. Now, I've done that for three decades, commuting back and forth from Illinois to Washington virtually every week. My family's back in Illinois, and that's where my kids were raised. But this would really be a break if a president of the United States is not calling the White House home and spending most of their time there. You know, other presidents in the past, Ronald Reagan spent a lot of time at Camp David. George W. Bush went down in his ranch in Texas a lot, spent a lot of time down there. But it really, the official residence was always known as 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. If President-elect Trump decides to do this differently, it's going to change the feeling in this town, the environment in this town when it comes to the continuity and the presence, regular presence of government.
And one of the senior Democrats, are there certain issues? I mean, McCaskill's already been pressing the whole Medicare thing. Are there certain issues that you know are going to be a flashpoint from the get-go and that you expect to be a lot of fireworks on early on?
His appointees, Congressman Price, who's, I believe that name is correct, with HHS, mm-hmm. Is a very conservative view when it comes to Social Security and Medicare, as does Speaker Ryan in the U.S. House. And I couldn't agree more with Senator McCaskill. There are a lot of us who believe that Medicare has proven a success since the 1960s, and 40 million plus Americans count on it. And people who want to privatize it and turn it over to private insurance companies, there's going to be a real fight on their hands to try to do that. I don't know what their plans are with Social Security, but the people, many of them, have no other recourse but to live with that Social Security check. And if there's any threat to that source of income, there really is going to be a fight over it.
Now you serve on the Senate Judiciary Committee, which I believe will decide whether Jeff Sessions, your colleague, will become the next Attorney General. First of all, is that correct?
Yes. Yes, so that's right.
You've served with him for many years now, probably. I think he came into the Senate shortly after you. And I've heard mixed things about him. I don't know anything about him other than what I've read. I've heard some of his Democratic colleagues describe him as a very gentlemanly, nice person who you know, works very hard. I've heard other things about his past, about how he may have racial animus dating back to when he was a U.S. attorney. You've served with him for a long time. I'd like to get your perspective on what he's like as a person, as a potential attorney general, and what your mindset is going to be going into that confirmation hearing.
Well, that's a good question, and not easily answered. But Jeff Sessions started as a U.S. attorney who was nominated to be a federal district court judge. This is before I arrived in the Senate. When he came before the Senate Judiciary Committee, there were certain things in his background which raised a question about whether or not he had involved any racist conduct, or said things that were suggestive of that. As a result, his judgeship came to a halt. He didn't make it through the committee. Fast forward a few years, he gets elected to the Senate and serves on the Senate Judiciary Committee, which could be a first. And so I've watched him up close. I had an important measure about the federal sentencing for crack cocaine. We had a disparity in sentencing that was just indefensible, 100-to-1 crack cocaine over powdered cocaine. And I wanted to bring it down to 1-to-1, where I think it should be. He didn't want to see it go down that far, but we agreed on 18-to-1. The disparity in sentencing between the two, a substantial change from 100, and it was a Durbin-Sessions bill that passed out of the committee on the floor of the Senate, then the House, onto President Obama's desk, where it was signed into law. He points to that now as evidence of bipartisanship, and he's right. It was quite an achievement, and I was glad to have his help with it. But now I've got a criminal justice bill with Senator Grassley that goes into another area that he has spoken out against over and over again. So it's kind of hard to put him in a neat compartment or category. I'm going to save for the hearings, which should be very, very interesting, questions about his views when it comes to federal criminal sentencing as well as immigration. He's been very outspoken against any form of immigration reform.
Now, obviously, you don't want to get into the weeds yet, but when you look at the nominees so far, are there particular ones? I mean, McCaskill yesterday was hinting at Price that are going to be, that's going to be the guy we're going to go after, or the woman that we're going to go after because we think they're totally unqualified. Are there a couple that just stand out already? I mean, you mentioned in Sessions' case you want to hear from the hearings. I was just wondering if there's any that are like, we're really going to be resistant to this person. I'm interested in what you're seeing so far.
I don't want to be conclusive on it, in fairness to the nominees, but I will tell you that I agree with Senator McCaskill when it comes to Congressman Price, and as the head of the Health and Human Services Department, that department is responsible for education, for many programs affecting senior citizens, just across the board, public health issues. And you can understand, as she said, this is not an easy ask to put him in this position. When his views on Medicare, for example, he suggested privatizing Medicare, are unacceptable to most members of Congress in both political parties. Senator Sessions on the Department of Justice, I think that's going to be another controversial choice. We still don't know on the State Department. It's gone back and forth. Mitt Romney shows up one day, David Petraeus the next. We don't know who's going to ultimately emerge there as the nominee. But it appears that some of these nominees are in for a real hearing where some tough questions are going to be asked, and it's not an automatic vote on either side until those questions are answered.
It's going to really come down to whether some Republicans end up voting against some of these nominees, because I think the margin is very, very slim. If two or three vote against one and all the Democrats vote against it, I think that could sink a potential cabinet nominee. Is that a fair assessment?
Three. If three Republicans join all the Democrats, 51 will be voting against a nominee. So that would be the end of the story, as I see it. If it were a tie vote, the vice president could come in and break the tie. But with 51 votes, the nominee doesn't make it. And most Republicans in the Senate have been positive toward the president-elect being allowed to choose his own cabinet. I couldn't agree with that sentiment more. But when things come out in the course of a hearing, that really make it a public and controversial issue, some Republicans may view this differently and join us if we are resisting a nominee.
Now, one of the big issues for you for months, actually, or years, has been the whole Dreamer situation. Immigration reform, what to do with the young people who are brought over as children and are now adults, and in many cases are either being deported in some cases, even though they haven't done anything wrong. I noticed that today that you were heartened by some of Trump's comments in the Time magazine piece. I'm interested in your take on, A, what can be done? Should Obama be doing something before he leaves? I know there's been talk of some sort of blanket amnesty. I'm just interested in what your thoughts are, since this is a key issue for you.
The category of Dreamers is one that we invented in legislation 16 years ago. And as you described it, it's a young person, someone brought to the country as a baby, a toddler, an infant, a young boy or girl by parents, and is undocumented in America. These young people, by and large, have grown up in this country, grown to the schools of our nation, some of them to college, and they're undocumented. They have no status in the United States. And what I've argued is if they finish their schooling and they have no criminal problems in their background, they should be given a chance for legal status. We haven't passed it into law, but President Obama issued an executive order called DACA, D-A-C-A. And this DACA order said that if you're one of these, you can apply, pay a fee of about $500 for processing, go through a criminal background check, and if you're approved, get a temporary, underline the word temporary, two-year protection from being deported and be allowed to work. 744,000 young people have done that. They qualify under this. The new president has said, I'm going to rescind it. I don't believe in that executive order. And we have said back to him, so what happens to these young people? For example, there are 28 who are in medical school in Illinois. If you take away their permit to work legally in America, they have to drop out of medical school and can't become doctors. That's not a good outcome. We were encouraged by a statement made by President-elect Trump in Time magazine, which acknowledged that many of these young people did deserve a chance. We're hoping to build on that with a bipartisan bill that allows them to stay, at least on a temporary basis, while we debate the larger issue of immigration.
I wanted to ask, just as a former resident of Illinois, I know for a fact that Illinois is a very diverse state. There's a large Hispanic population, large Asian population, large African-American population. And I think that a lot of the rhetoric that came out of this campaign and that's coming even in the transition about building walls and deporting lots of people has stoked fear in a lot of different segments of American society. I mean, are you hearing that from constituents, that they're worried that this rhetoric is going to seep into their everyday lives? And even for people that may be in the country, from another country, are they worried about family members being deported or being forcibly removed from the country?
Well, let me just say at the outset, I'm sitting here in my office in the Capitol building. Directly behind me on my desk is my mother's naturalization certificate. She was an immigrant to this country, brought here at the age of 2 from Lithuania by her mother, grew up in East St. Louis, Illinois, and I'm proud to be her son and to be serving in the Senate. That's my story, it's my family story, and it's the American story. And most of us have to go back a generation or more to point to that ancestor who came to this country. But we are a diverse nation. Now we have a concern and fear about immigration. Some of that is driven by terrorism and the fear that some immigrant may come here who will do harm to America. I want to do everything in my power, reasonably, within the constitutional limits, to make sure that doesn't happen. And I think we all agree on it. The second concern is these immigrants will come and take American jobs. Most immigrants, including my family, came here and took whatever they could get, and some of those jobs were jobs most people didn't want. That's still the case today. Many immigrants are working in low-wage jobs, jobs in packing houses and slaughterhouses and places that people don't really want to work if they can avoid it. So I don't think the job threat is a major worry that you can prove out statistically. What we need to have is an orderly process here. Keep America safe. Make sure we don't open the doors, throw them up open wide to anybody who wants to come, but have an orderly process, particularly for those who've been here and proven that they're responsible members of our community.
Now, As you're looking at this, and this is in the context of the election as well, immigration was a big issue during the election, and some think that that's what prompted some people, because of their fears, to vote for Donald Trump. I mean, you were from a state that did go for Clinton, and without replaying what happened on the election, are the things that the Democrats need to do going forward, not just on immigration, but on other things, in order to appeal to some of these disaffected voters who may or may not end up being satisfied with what Trump and his administration do over the next few years?
Well, if I, you know, Hillary Clinton ran an aggressive campaign, a hard campaign. I supported her and was proud to do it. But if I look back with a critical eye, I would say we didn't clearly offer an economic message. And, you know, you go back to the early Clinton campaigns when Carville was saying it's the economy, stupid. You have to make sure that the opening bid in any presidential race is an economic promise of how things can get better. We didn't do that. And as a party, we need to do that. We've got to do it in specific terms, you know, in terms of the wages paid to workers in America. We support increasing the minimum wage. Most Republicans oppose it, including Donald Trump. We also believe that people ought to have accessible, affordable health insurance. There seems to be a division of opinion on the Republican side about that, but we feel pretty strongly. I happen to agree with Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. The first 2 years of college should be free, so kids from working families don't have to worry about shouldering a debt to get through those first 2 years at least. So we need to build up the case that the Democratic approach gives working families a better chances at success than what the Republicans have to offer. We didn't do it effectively. I think it's one of the reasons we lost the presidency.
Now, will you be able to retool in time for 2018 when McCaskill and a number of Democratic senators will be on the ballot? I mean, at the same time, at that point, we'll have a sense of what the public thinks of how Trump's performance is so far. That, I mean, as you're looking at this, just kind of your take on what Democrats have to do the next couple of years to get out of the wilderness at the same time you're trying to work with or block Trump.
You know, I got up Wednesday, November the 9th. I prayed for a miracle while I was asleep, and it didn't happen. And I woke up, and it was clear that Donald Trump would be the next president. And I thought to myself, now, what if the tables were turned? What if Hillary had won this? What would you have expected of the Trump supporters? Three things. One, accept the election and its results. Second, try to find something to work with the other side on, something constructive and positive to help this country. And third, argue your values, but do it in a civilized way, in a constitutional way. And that's what I'm holding myself to in terms of a standard. And I think, frankly, we can find things to work with the Trump administration on. Maybe it's infrastructure. We sure need it. We haven't had enough investment in our country, and we need the jobs. So that may work. But when it comes to basic values, there are going to be some real differences between the Trump administration and the Republican Congress and what we Democrats believe. I just talked about three basics: the minimum wage, health insurance, paying for college education. We also feel the tax code needs to be changed for the better. One thing that maybe Donald Trump would agree with, President-elect Trump would agree with, and that is, I think that companies that keep their businesses in the United States, pay a decent wage with decent benefits, give veterans preference, those companies deserve a tax break. No tax break for those who move overseas. That sounds like a Trump position, doesn't it? And I think, frankly, if the president takes that position, he'd find a lot of Democrats backing him up and the resistance coming from his own political party. So there'll be opportunities. I'm looking forward to them.
Now, the Republicans already have signaled they want to repeal Obamacare, like, immediately. I know there's that dispute on whether or not they really have a replacement option. I'm interested in your take on that. And what do Democrats do to either, especially in the Senate, because you're basically, that's where the fight's going to be. I'm interested in your take on how you see it right now.
Well, there's only been one perfect law, and it was carried down the side of a mountain on clay tablets by Senator Moses. Every other law needs some work, and this one does too, the Affordable Care Act. Currently, the costs are too high, and there are many aspects of it which we should address. But we've been unable in the last 6 or 8 years to get the Republicans to sit down at the table and talk about any changes. They want to repeal it. And we've said over and over again, well, 20 million people now have health insurance who didn't have it before. So if you want to repeal this, what will you replace it with? They don't have a replacement. They still don't have a replacement. Yesterday, a major hospital organization came to Washington and did a press conference and said, please do not repeal the Affordable Care Act until you have something to replace it with. Otherwise, we're afraid a lot of hospitals that are on the margins, serving the inner city, serving rural areas, are going to be forced to close, which is something none of us want to see. So I just say to my Republican friends, if you're bound and determined to repeal it, take the responsible position and come up with a replacement that doesn't jeopardize health care for the 20 million currently insured by it and doesn't close hospitals and reduce health services in areas we desperately need.
But how do you go about doing that if they're committed to, some of them are talking about putting a time limit on it, but then some of the insurance companies say they're going to pull out right away if that's the case. I mean, do you think you're going to be able to stall until and force the Democrats the Republicans to make changes or change their approach anyway? I'm just interested in what you think is going to happen in the short term.
God forbid there's a repeal and the healthcare structure in this country starts to crumble and health insurance companies start pulling out of areas and states and costs go up dramatically and hospitals close. I mean, that will be a terrible outcome. So it reminds me of the sign in the store that when you're out there traveling around the country, it says, if you break it, you own it. If the Republicans decide to repeal this and don't have an alternative to move to, and we start seeing serious problems in our healthcare system across America, and hospitals are forced into closure, then they've handled this very poorly. If they want to come up with an alternative, I'll sit and listen. I've been waiting for their ideas for a long time. But it has to serve the basic needs of this country. That is making sure that there's more peace of mind and health coverage than currently we have today, at least as much, if not more, and that we have the professionals in medical care across this country who are being compensated adequately to continue in the business and to attract even more young, bright doctors, nurses, and others to the profession.
Is there any other issues that you're going to be paying particularly close attention in the next couple of years?
Well, there are going to be quite a few of them. We mentioned infrastructure. We've mentioned health care. We've talked about the immigration issue, which we still have to deal with. I still think that we need to have a fundamental debate in this country about the creation of good-paying manufacturing jobs. We've lost a lot of them. Trade was responsible for part of it, although it gets most of the blame. The other part is just modernization, improvements in productivity, new technology. How are we going to be able to get that new group of incoming employees in St. Louis and East St. Louis and Illinois and Missouri trained and skilled so that they can take on good-paying manufacturing jobs? We're not doing a good enough job at that. Starting at sixth grade forward, we need to make sure that we are educating and training people so that they're ready to take on these jobs that they can make a decent living at. That isn't done enough, and we need more focus on it.
Have you been able to talk to Trump specifically, since the election, to talk about some of this?
No, I've never met the man, and I think that'll change in the months to come, but I haven't had that opportunity.
It's one of the benefits of being the Senate Minority Whip that you probably will get to meet with the president every now and then, I would imagine.
Now, I've
managed to meet with a few of them, and I just say it's a great experience. And, even presidents like George W. Bush, we disagreed on so many things. When I met him, I thought, I like this guy. You can't help but like this guy.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to meeting Donald Trump someday, and I hope that we can work together on some things.
Now, you've been close to Barack Obama from the get-go. Are there things that you've been advising him that he should do before he leaves? I mean, I'm sure he does listen to you. I'm just interested in your thoughts about what you can say about that.
Well, I've talked to him quite a bit, and he's kind enough to invite my wife, Loretta, over with me the other night for a small dinner party that Michelle and the president had in honor of Harry Reid. And we talked about a lot of things, what he had accomplished, what we'd been through, what's important. He's very proud of the fact that we've reduced the number of uninsured people in this country dramatically with the Affordable Care Act. He's proud of Wall Street reform, which really put us back on our feet after the miserable recession we went through back in 2007, 2008. And he's also proud of the program he had to restore the economy, which was losing 800,000 jobs a month. So there are many things The one thing that he and I have talked about a lot, though, are the 744,000 DACA-eligible young people we talked about earlier in the program. We want to make sure that they are protected from being deported or losing their chances to go to work or go to school. And I know he's thinking about that a lot. I am too.
Well, as an Illinois resident, I am looking forward to visiting his presidential library in a few years. It'll be the second presidential library in Illinois next to the Abraham Lincoln one. And, you know, that's one of the benefits of being the president from Illinois, that you get to build your presidential library there.
So. Now, there will be an Illinois governor's race in 2 years. Any thoughts at this point? I mean, as the senior senator, as you're looking at what's going on in your state?
Well, there are a number of people who have come forward to talk to me about running. No one's made a firm decision to do that, to run against Bruce Rauner, the current Republican governor. I will tell you that our state is in a political and budgetary crisis, and I think I'm using that word in the proper context. We are building a deficit, which I don't know how we'll ever be able to deal with. And we are cutting back on safety net programs for some of the most vulnerable people in our state because of the inability of the legislative leaders in Springfield and the new governor to agree on a budget. I pray that that's going to end soon. It's a disaster. I've never seen it worse. When I go down to communities like Carbondale, Southern Illinois University, because of the uncertainty of state funding, there's uncertainty in terms of enrollment. And that, you know, reverberates through the faculty and administrators and the economy of Jackson County, Illinois, Carbondale, Illinois. So we have these recession-like circumstances brought on by our state budget crisis. Same thing in Charleston, Illinois. Same thing in Macomb, Illinois. So we really have to get that solved in our state. It is a terrible condition which is hurting working families and communities across the state.
Now, Rauner, like Trump, is a businessman who had never held political office before, and that's also true like in Florida and Michigan. Are there any lessons here as you're having dealt with this in your own state and looking ahead with Trump, just general lessons aside from political views?
Well, I think, you know, I can't tell you what's going to happen with the new president. Let's give him a chance, wait and see. But when it comes to the governor of Illinois, what we've proven is you can make hundreds of millions of dollars and become wealthy beyond your wildest dreams. And that still doesn't mean you know how to manage a state or work in a political environment with a government. It just doesn't follow. And I'm sorry, in Illinois' case, it doesn't, because we need leadership to deal with this budget crisis.
Well, we'll be looking forward to watching that race. And we just want to thank you again for taking some time to talk with us. For all of our stories, stlpublicradio.org. Follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. Follow Joe on Twitter at
Jay Manis. It's J-M-A-N-N-I-E-S.
And how would people be able to follow you on social media or any other place on the World Wide Web, Senator?
Well, if you go in looking for Durbin for Senate, you're going to find websites to your heart's content.
Well, we will make sure to tell all of our listeners to get their hearts contented by looking at those websites. Thank you so much.
Good talking to you. Thanks a lot.
We'll talk
to you
soon.
Thank you, sir.